practicing veterinarian. I come from Indianapolis. It's actually kind of a nice picture of Indianapolis, just down the road a few hours. Indianapolis is also going to be the home of the Super Bowl in 2012, and the little asterisk there was because it was a mark of great civic dyspepsia, not knowing whether we would have the Super Bowl or not, but it appears we actually are going to have a Super Bowl this year, so we're kind of excited about that. My own practice is actually a small animal practice, so I take care of dogs and cats, which makes me superbly unqualified to speak about this subject, but I'm going to try it anyway. But it also is a mark, really, of the fact that we are transitioning within my profession. Within veterinary medicine, it's a very different relationship we have in my practice now than what a veterinarian 100 years ago would have had. So our relationship with animals has actually changed. In 1911, a century ago, veterinarians were exclusively almost agrarian. So this nice picture of the pastoral setting, literally, of cattle out grazing, that's what veterinarians did. It was almost exclusively male. It was agricultural. And suburbanization has changed all of that. We now find that, first of all, that doesn't exactly look like a backyard flock there. That is more what we would expect to find chickens raised as today. And our practices are now mostly female run. Mostly my profession is filled with new veterinarians that are over 80%, classes are over 80% female. So it's becoming more feminized, and more of us are doing small animal things, puppies, kittens, cats, dogs, companion animals. That's more where veterinary medicine is at right now. And that corresponds with a society that is more distant with where we get our food. We don't think so much about where our food comes. I think there are a lot of people that wouldn't admit it, but they think you pick a T-bone off a meat tree. And that's kind of the idea of the fact that, that meat doesn't really come from killing and eating animals. And so that's part of why we have to, I think, be more reflective on what the lives of animals are like. So it's also meant, as has been alluded to before, that it, when we see these confinement operations for animals, the fact that the demand for meat has gone up so significantly in emerging markets like China, like India, like Brazil, some of these countries that are tasting capitalism, and I mean that literally too, they are increasing the demand for meat. There's not enough land in the world to have traditional methods of agriculture and still provide the meat that is demanded by society. So the efficiencies of scale have made it cheaper. So meat is cheaper than it's ever been, relatively speaking, but the demand is higher. Now, this has led to actually some changes that brought in the 60s in the United Kingdom these things that were termed the five freedoms. And these were elaborated on. The five freedoms were actually freedom from thirst and hunger, from discomfort, from pain, injury, and disease, freedom to express normal behavior, and freedom from fear and distress. The other things were sort of added and elaborated in the late 70s. But these five freedoms really became sort of a foundation for an ethic for how we should treat animals. This is how we should look at how animal agriculture operates. Interestingly, Proposition 2 in California that was passed, as propositions are, by popular vote in 2008, that required, it made for requiring improved conditions for livestock there, and used these as the basic principles for it. Now, the great challenge for this is that this makes an interesting talk for ethics. It is a more challenging thing to codify. And they're actually finding that a lot of these things are held up in court right now in California because it's just hard to define some of these sorts of things. So kind of one of the challenges of passing law based on popular vote. So if you avoid this terrible pun, there's some advantages to legislative sausage making because they sometimes work that out first. But that has been a challenge in California to try and see how these five freedoms can be codified. So Jay had mentioned that among secular views of animals, we really start to fundamentally define the moral status of animals. We can't have a discussion about what the right way to treat animals is unless we can talk about what their moral status is. And so if we want to talk about welfare, We have to take a look at what is out there, both from secular and Christian points of view. Now, Peter Singer, he's someone that everyone is familiar with. Tom Regan uses a different approach, but they both have a similar goal for improved moral status for animals, we'll say. Now, Peter Singer is a utilitarian, of course, and as a good utilitarian, he focuses on animals, their ability to suffer pain. And so that's the basis for which to afford them moral interests. He echoes his spiritual grandfather, if you will, Jeremy Bentham, who points to the capacity for suffering as the vital characteristic that gives a being the right to equal consideration. So again, as utilitarians, they're going to look at pain as the basis to understand if animals have at least moral interests. He rejects speciesism. Speciesism is very common in his writings, which Singer, in his quote, calls a prejudice or attitude of bias in favor of members of one's own species and against those of members of another species. And he makes these akin to sexism and racism. Now, there's problems with that, certainly. I mean, I think most would agree that sexism and racism are wrong because they are injustices between two equal moral agents, whereas it's hard for humans and animals to be considered equal moral agents. I think Singer perhaps considers that, but I think most would have a hard time with that. Even if you have a high view of the moral status of animals, I don't think you can make that argument as easily, just based on the difference between humans and the moral reasoning that humans have. Patrick Lee and Robert George also look at inconsistencies in what Singer has to say by saying that he's basing this on what they call an accidental attribute that varies in degree, and that's even within a species. So we don't know. It's an attribute that isn't clearly consistent. It's not something that animals can truly convey to us. In my profession, we've had a hard time understanding how much pain animals suffer. They can't talk to us and tell us. I think we've perhaps underestimated it, but we just don't know what level of pain they can undergo. And so it becomes a very, very hard thing in creatures that can't communicate that and in which we don't have great ways to completely assess those things. So that would be Singer's view. Now, taking the next approach, Tom Regan, who is from North Carolina, takes a rights-based or deontologic approach to it. And his take is that animals, especially mammals and birds, have rights on the basis that they are subjects of a life. So they aren't just sentient creatures. They can't just feel pain and process pain, but they are creatures in possession of psychological capabilities for desires and memories and other characteristics that we would traditionally consider human. So in Kantian terms, he finds that they are not to be used as mere means. We owe them duties. And curiously, he defines that animal rights should apply to all normal mammalian animals aged one or more. Kind of a curious place that he chooses that. I would hope that I have a very long lifespan in Tom Regan's view. It seems a little bit random to me. So happy first birthday, you get rights. But that is in his writings how he describes when that happens. All of those creatures possess inherent value, the same inherent value, and should be equally respected as possessors of rights. Carl Cohen, who is from the University of Michigan and is a critic, makes an argument that I think is a good one that says animals, unlike people, can't make autonomous moral decisions and can't be moral agents. Doesn't mean we don't afford them moral considerations, but they can't be moral agents. And so the transfer of rights from the moral world of humans to the animal world doesn't make any sense in his mind. And in his quote, he says, "To say that rats have rights is to apply to the world of rats a concept that makes very good sense when applied to humans, but makes no sense at all when applied to rats." So rights aren't of any value because animals don't have any use practically for them. So with both of these philosophers, these philosophical views, we find the only logical outcome for either is abolitionism. We have no right to eat animals. causes them pain, and it takes away their right to live. And to their credit, I guess, both of them, I think, are consistent with that. They are abolitionists. They don't believe that meat eating is right in the least. So what do Christians have to say? The Christian that we hear of the most is Andrew Lindsay. And Andrew Lindsay is an Anglican priest and an Oxford professor. He has just started the Journal of Animal Ethics, which is an interesting read. It's only been out a very short bit of time, but he wrote a 1976 book on animal rights. And really, I won't go into a lot of detail on Lindsay. It's fascinating to look at. His philosophical argument is kind of deontological, and I don't find it particularly compelling. It's interesting when he combines the theological and philosophical and kind of bridges those. He has a rights theory that he calls theos rights. And theos rights, which he elaborates in a 1995 book called Animal Theology, are God-given to God's creation. So God's creation, particularly the animals in it, have rights that are theos rights. The parts that I think are good about what Lindsay does is he rightly focuses on the dominion concept of humans over animals as a biblical foundation. And even he describes this dominion, which is found in Genesis 1:26-28, as inescapably fraught with moral responsibility, which I think is true. I think the dominion that God has within that passage certainly suggests that. It lies in the role of stewardship of nature, all of creation, including animals, under the authority of the king, God himself. So humans do have moral superiority, Lindsay finds, because of our moral consciousness and responsibility. So we have abilities that God has given us to morally exercise dominion over animals. Now, interestingly, in the Genesis passage, in the creation narrative, And I am no Hebrew scholar, and hopefully nobody else is either, but the word is rada. It's the closest I can get to pronouncing it correctly. That's the word for dominion. It implies both power and responsibility. And it's a strong word. It's used elsewhere in the Old Testament to talk about domination militarily and things like that. So it's got a very powerful control connotation that goes with it, but responsibility is also a big part of that too. So creation was declared good by God, and humanity's been entrusted with its care. So irresponsible stewardship and violence to it is an injustice to the one in whose image we are created. So the other thing Lindsay tends to do is to also talk about eschatology. And in here he, among other places, uses Romans 8:21 passage where the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. So the way creation was established had a very strong mandate for the responsible stewardship of animals. The way the new creation will come about will include animals in that original created order of the fact that they're the view of no killing, no meat eating, we will be vegetarians or vegans again. Now, I do have a problem, certainly, even though I think he has some interesting things and links those things well, the fact that he links those things to rights, as I mentioned before, I have a very hard time with the idea of linking ethically rights to animals. I don't think it's a useful notion. I don't think that it's an easy bridge to cross. But he also makes at least some interesting discussions. I will mention really briefly Matthew Scully, who wrote a book called Dominion that is, he's not a scientist nor an ethicist, but he's a speechwriter, a George W. Bush speechwriter, who also wrote Sarah Palin's speech for the 2008 Republican Convention. Dominion, a very fascinating read, where he, I think, comes even closer to a biblical view. He is a Christian as well, a biblical view of dominion, but he makes animals very distinct from humans, And he finds that, in his words, those who construct elaborate theories based on rights or liberation can pull animals out of the world where affection and creaturely goodwill are possible. So, in fact, he finds that it's actually quite deleterious to pass along rights to animals because of the fact that when you do that, it takes away our chances for kindness, for goodness to them. And he makes some interesting comments on appropriate things. He talks a lot about these confinement operations. I think he tends to make some emotion-based arguments, which many are guilty of, but I think it's compelling stuff that he writes about nonetheless. So what does the Bible say about all this? What do other theologians say about it? The thing that I have found in reading other writings from theologians is that they seem to all talk a lot about that dominion role, that creation order, that role we have as responsible stewards in the fact that we were created in the ideal world to not kill and eat animals, that came later. And then they look at that eschatological position that says that we will, in fact, be no longer killing and eating animals later. The struggle is trying to find biblical things that make them, as they describe themselves, as moral vegetarians, that can really back that up a lot. And most sort of throw up their hands a bit and say they kind of have to go to extra-biblical sources to help them with that, because it isn't a normative for right now to make us vegetarians by looking at the in-between of creation, the original creation, and the new creation. So the in-between time is a struggle for many of them. Robert Winberg is one of them that I find really, really struggles with that. But we do find that there is plenty in the Bible that does talk about animals. Now, we've talked already about dominion that is found in Genesis in the creation order. But we see in the covenant with Noah in Genesis 9:10, which seems to sort of sanction meat eating at that point. It is interesting, the distinction that's made there, because this is, in Genesis, this is the last mention of the term image of God. It's used other places, but the Hebrew words for it, this is mentioned there, but it really reflects that humans are made in the image of God and makes that distinction with animals. That does talk about responsibility for animals, about draining the life from them, that the blood of animals has their life, so they are certainly living creatures worthy of some responsibility and respect, but it does make that great divide in there. We find in the Mosaic Law as well, in Exodus, I have those passages listed there, that it includes things like rest for animals on the Sabbath, provision of food for them in the fallow fields every seventh year for wildlife. Even the sacrificial system, which we sort of, our modern sensibilities find that really hard to deal with, that was very humane in its time. And there was a lot that shows a sort of level of kindness toward animals, even within that system of avoiding cruelty to animals. Prophets, when we look at Hosea and Zephaniah, Joel, it mentions the fact that suffering of animals is a product of sin. Human sinfulness has led to animal suffering. And so we see that God has concern for them. In Jonah, God expresses concern for humans and animal population of Nineveh. So we do see, despite the fact that we don't have huge overt passages in the Bible about an ethic for animals, we do see some evidence of that. And then I mentioned again the eschatological hope for animals in Isaiah and Revelation particularly, and the passage I read to you in Romans. So those are foundational as well to, as I mentioned, Lindsay and some of the others. The Imago Dei, the fact that human beings are serving in a dominion role as a part of being made in the image of God, I think tells us that our role as stewards of animal creation is soundly biblical. That's something that that while I think we grant a moral status to animals, there is a clear distinction between those and people. So, where do we take this from here? So what does that mean about animals? So if, in fact, we find that we have an ethic for being good stewards of animals, which I think is the biblical approach that is a more useful one than rights, then what do we find? So we've talked already about what some would call derisively, rather, factory farming. It's good shorthand, but essentially those confinement operations. This is a feedlot. Feedlots exist so that cattle can go there and get marbled. Basically, they get marbling in their meat. They eat a lot of grain. They don't walk around very much. You don't want them building up muscle, mostly. You mostly want them to get their meat so that it can be choice or prime meat. And so you get a lot of grain to do that. But they arguably perhaps have some of the least deleterious lives of some livestock, because some of their time is, for many of them, there are pastured before they get to that point, things like that. But then we look at others that are a little bit harder to deal with. That upper left, those are veal calves. And veal calves often get light deprived. They get iron deprived, confined to small pens, so you can get that milk-fed, very pale, tender white meat. And veal has the benefit health-wise of being lower in cholesterol. It's actually kind of not all that bad for you. But ethically, it has been a challenge because they don't lead terribly good lives, as we think. We are seeing changes, which is where popular opinion is taking things. There was an article not all that long ago about how we're seeing veal calves raised in crate and tether-free environments to get social interaction, freedom of movement, things like that. And they're getting marketed to restaurants. Restaurants will market this more compassionate veal. It doesn't look quite the same as the other, but veal consumption's going up again as far as that goes. So that's actually, depending on what you think of any of that, whether meat eating, good, bad, or otherwise, we're seeing some changes there. Now, swine production, I won't talk about a great deal. There are two things that are seen here. You can see they're up on slatted floors just to largely keep them out of the fact that they can get parasites and bacterial infections and all sorts of other things from being in their own wastes, but certainly can lead to some foot problems. This farrowing crate, farrowing the term for when sows give birth to piglets, that looks really, really awful, and there is some science behind it. I mean, sows can, in hog operations, can roll over and crush their piglets, and so there is some science to it. These are things that I think lead us to understanding where a stewardship ethic plays out within these confinement operations, because it would be wonderful if, in fact, we cut our meat production down. I think it would be a good thing if there's less demand for meat. The reality of it is that we have emerging markets that are demanding more meat. It's going to keep going up, as we see, and we will find that this is a genie that is not easy to put back in the bottle. This is something where we have these operations that exist, and we aren't going back to a probably more romanticized view of the way farming was and the way animal welfare was in the past, for all its good and bad, because there have been improvements in life for animals because of this and some negative things. But we have to look at the fact that there's science here, yet it's fraught with moral decisions. So where I want to take this is looking at the animals that arguably may have the worst lives. Here's kind of a dramatic example. This is foie gras. If anybody likes this, you don't have to raise your hand. But it essentially French for fatty liver. You can see here, that's a rather sinister-looking feeder over there, isn't it? You've got kind of a mean-looking picture. But you're gavaging, it's called. You're trying to feed to get a nice fat liver in these geese. You can do it in ducks as well. But you want a nice yellow fat liver to in these sickly animals to create this product here, which is quite a delicacy and sells for a great deal. I think this is a hard thing to reconcile with being wise stewards of animals. I have a hard time doing that and won't try. But what about poultry operations for most of the chickens that we see? What do we think about that? I put the question mark up there, is this responsible stewardship? Well, at face value, we look at some things that kind of bother us. I mean, we see them in these cages and for these laying hens that are kind of crammed together. We see this de-beaked bird over here who's had the beak taken off of the end there. And then we see them hanging upside down, prepared for slaughter. So when we look at this, it kind of triggers some emotion to us. Again, I would really like to pick my chicken off a chicken tree, not have to think about it. But when we look at what chicken behavior is like and things, then there are some things that make sense in here. Chickens, first of all, when you look at the debeaking, chickens are not altogether nice animals. The word pecking order came from chickens because they do tend to peck and injure each other. And so there are rationales, even in backyard operations, where with a procedure like electrocautery, you take the edge into the beak off, and it can be a that could be an understandable reason to do that because of the fact that they can injure each other. Chickens tend to kind of cluster together. Even if you put them out in a big circle, they kind of hang out together. And so it's not as bad as it might seem to be in close proximity to each other. And then the reason they're hung upside down before they go to slaughter is because that is how you relax a bird. So, strangely enough, they are getting relaxed by doing that, and that's a less traumatic way to slaughter. Do I like all of those things? No. The reason I bring all of that up is because I think that we have to look at the fact that we need to look at science. We need to look at knowledge of behavior, physiology. A poultry veterinarian that I know named Pat Wakenell from Purdue has said two things that I think are significant. She mentions that we do restrict some freedoms to keep birds alive, but we can offer them freedom from parasites and predators, so there is an inherent trade-off in what we do with that. We still have to find what is the responsible way to do that, but we do have that. The other thing that I think resounds within a stewardship ethics that she mentioned is that housing does not define welfare. Husbandry does. So how we care for these birds in whatever operations we have is significant. And that's, again, fraught with moral discussions. So I'll just finish by saying I think a biblical stewardship ethic does compel us to use science to make fundamentally moral decisions about what's appropriate for the animals that God's given us to care for food. And I don't think the notion of animal rights is very helpful in advancing that. We have to realize that intensive farming operations are going to continue to exist as long as there's a demand for meat. And I mentioned that demand's not subsiding. We won't return in a large-scale fashion to the small family farm model for meat production. We just won't. So while I'm uncomfortable with a lot of what these confinement operations mean, and there's a lot I still need to learn about it, to be honest with you, as a small animal veterinarian. Our first duty is to apply science to make wise moral decisions and change what needs to be changed within the framework we've got first. We can change behavior as much as we can, but we have to work to change the husbandry of the operations that are there. And for some, that's abstaining altogether, and that's fine. For others, it's going to be working for reform of poor husbandry conditions, even taking action against those who sustain them. And then we'll use the knowledge of animal behavior, infectious disease, and physiology to give them the best environments possible. That's an act of responsible stewardship to a God who's given us a lot of responsibility over his animals. So that is all I have, and the happy kitty and I say thank you very much for having me today. So hope to keep us on going.